In Seattle and the Pacific Northwest, mountains are a constant presence. As everyone in this room knows, we have in view not one but two mountain ranges, the Cascades and Olympics. When the clouds lift, on occasion that is regrettably all too rare in our rainy climate, we have a clear view of Mount Rainier from several places on our campus. And here is an old undated photograph from Rainier Vista, contained in the University of Washington Digital Collection. I don't know the date of it, but you see there are not very many buildings there. I think it's a little different now. You wouldn't really be able to see quite so well. And then if we look west, we can see almost the entire Olympic mountain range. Familiar sights, I think, to all of you. Well, mountain viewing was not always so simple. Indeed, humans did not always find mountains so inviting. Although the ancient Greeks showed some feeling for the mountain landscape in which they lived, as Walter Kirchner has put it, for the ancient Romans, quote, mountains and particularly the Alps evoke no aesthetic response, unquote. The changing European perception of mountains has been well researched in a book by Marjorie Hope Nicholson titled Mountain Gloom and Mountain Glory. There's Marjorie Hope Nicholson, who I think was, somebody told me, was the first female chair of the English department at Columbia. A very, very fine scholar. And this is the cover of her book, Mountain Gloom and Mountain Glory. It was first published in 1959, and it has been recently reprinted by our own University of Washington Press in 1999. So this book has endured for some time. Professor Nicholson shows that in Europe, even as late as the 17th century, writers and travelers depicted mountains as warts and blisters and even worse. James Howell, in one of his familiar letters on important subjects, gives the following account of his trip to the Alps in 1621. The Pyrenees are not so high and hideous as the Alps, but for our mountains in Wales, they are but molehills in comparison of these. They are pygmies compared to giants, but blisters to impostumes, or pimples to warps. How many of you people know what an impostume is? It's an abscess or a cyst. I had to look this up in the OED myself. Mountains were frequently called rubbish heaps. As Nicholson puts it, they were, quote, waste places of the world with little meaning and less charm for men who crossed the Alps only to reach the plains, unquote. The view that mountains were a garbage heap had much to do with the notion that before the Great Flood, the earth was level and smooth. But after the fall of Adam and Eve, nature began to decay. Mountains, in particular, were regarded as hideous monstrosities. This notion of the mountain Nicholson calls mountain gloom. She argues that it was not until the 18th or even 19th century that European writers began to sing the praises of mountain splendor, what she terms mountain glory. One can, of course, view a mountain from afar or by physically climbing it. Mountains can also be viewed in the imagination or in the mind's eye, to use a phrase from St. Augustine. In a famous passage in Book 10 of his Confessions, Augustine comments, presumably unfavorably, on those who only go out and gaze on the landscape. This is on the screen there. Yet men go out and gaze in astonishment at high mountains, the huge waves of the sea, the broad reaches of rivers, the ocean that encircles the world, or the stars in the courses, but they pay no attention to themselves. They do not marvel at the thought that while I have been mentioning all these things, I have been not looking at them with my eyes, and I could not even speak of mountains or waves, rivers or stars, which are things that I have seen, or of the ocean, which I know only on the evidence of others, unless I could see them in my mind's eye and in my memory, and with the same vast spaces between them that would be there if I were looking at them in the world outside myself. And so it would seem that Augustine was more interested in his search for spirituality than mountains. Augustine's lines that are cited on the screen here again appear again in a famous European account of climbing a mountain. This is by this person. I hope most of you know who this is, Petrarch. This is in a famous letter that he wrote to somebody who was actually his confessor and also an Augustinian. Dionigi da Borgo San Sepolcro. This is in his Familiares 4, in which he provides an account of his ascent of Mount Ventoux, a limestone peak. It soars to a height of 6,273 feet in the Provençal Alps. Petrarch claims he made the ascent of Mount Ventoux on the 26th of April, 1336, but apparently he did not write the letter until 1352 or 1353, about 10 years after Dionigi had died. And thus, this is an example of an event recollected many years later, and perhaps it is subject to reinterpretation and even fictionalization. Although the letter has many interesting details that would be of interest to a student of mountain writing or even mountain climbing, I do not have time to record them all here. And I will simply report the basic outline. Petrarch climbs Mount Ventoux with his brother. However, they take separate routes. The brother ascends by the ridgeline, which is more perilous but shorter. Petrarch follows a smoother but longer path that proves to be more exhausting and frustrating. When he and his brother finally reach the summit, Petrarch gazes out and takes in a panoramic view of the mountains near Lyon to the right and the ocean near Marseille to the left. Flowing immediately below him was the Rhône River. At this point, Petrarch takes out of his pocket a miniature edition of Augustine's Confessions, a book that he reputedly always carried with him. And he opened it at random and chanced on the following passage. Yet men go out and gaze in astonishment at high mountains, the huge waves of the sea, the broad reaches of rivers, the ocean that encircles the world, or the stars in the courses, but they pay no attention to themselves. Have we seen this before? This is, of course, the passage from Augustine's Confessions that I already cited. Petrarch then says, "I was stunned." Although his brother asks him to read on, Petrarch closed the book angry that, quote, he still admired earthly things, unquote. Satisfied with what he had seen of the mountain, he then turns his inner eye toward himself. Petrarch says not a word as he descends the mountain. In his letter, Petrarch does express some delight at the scenery. For example, just before he takes out his copy of Augustine, he says that he, quote, admired every detail of the scene, unquote. Nevertheless, at the same moment, he rebukes himself for relishing earthly enjoyment. Toward the end of the letter, he remarks that as he descended the mountain, quote, it seemed to me hardly higher than a cubit compared to the height of human contemplation, unquote. And as Marjorie Nicholson aptly puts it, quote, for a moment, upon Mount Ventoux, Petrarch had seen the mountain glory. The moment passed, and his eyes were darkened by the mountain gloom, unquote. And indeed, Petrarch's account has little to do with mountain viewing. It is more about his personal spiritual journey. And you wouldn't believe the number of allegorical interpretations I read of this letter, maybe to excess. Anyway, I open my lecture with this account of the mountain climbing adventure of the great medieval European writer and thinker Petrarch as prologue to my main subject, the viewing of mountains in medieval China. The medieval period in China is somewhat earlier than the medieval period of Europe. It extends from the 3rd century to the 10th century CE. Most of what I say will come from the early medieval period, that is the 3rd to the 6th centuries. The mountain has long played an important role in China's cultural history. Paul de Mieville, arguably the most distinguished European sinologist of the 20th century, has written the most illuminating study of the role of the mountain in Chinese literary art. And this is the first page of this wonderful article from France Asie, 1965. Now, I should note that although de Mieville is usually referred to as the great French sinologist, He was actually Swiss. And during the period that he occupied the chair of sinology at the Collège de France, he maintained a residence in the Swiss Alps. Well, de Mieuville begins his article by citing the following words reputedly uttered by Confucius himself. "The wise take pleasure in waters, but the benevolent take pleasure in mountains. For the wise are active and the benevolent are still. The wise are content, but the benevolent live long." We can see from this passage some important traditional Chinese views of the mountain. First, it is associated with the moral quality of what the Chinese call ren, which has multiple meanings: benevolence, kindness, humanity, goodness. Second, the mountain is unmovable, and thus it is associated with the quality of tranquility and calmness. Finally, because of its durability, the mountain is associated with the idea of longevity and even immortality. In ancient China, the mountain was also attributed with the power of generation and birth. My philologist friends will appreciate this one, I think. For example, one of the earliest dictionaries, the Shiming, terms explained by Liu Xi, this is late 2nd, early 3rd century CE, glosses the word shan, mountain, with the homophone chan. They're virtual homophones in Han Dynasty Chinese, generation or production. The mountains were thus considered the site of most living beings. This idea is found in the following passage from a work by Han Ying of the 2nd century BCE, who comments on Confucius' statement that the benevolent take pleasure in mountains. And there it is. "It is mountains to which all people raise their eyes and look. Grass and trees grow there. All living beings flourish there. The birds that fly assemble there. The beasts that walk take their repose there. And while all alike take from them, they show favoritism to none. Mountains put forth clouds and make the wind circulate. They soar up between heaven and earth. Through them, heaven and earth are completed, and the state is at peace. These are the reasons why the benevolent take pleasure in mountains." And the translation, with one minor revision, is by my teacher, the late James Robert Hightower of Harvard University or the Cambridge Community College. He wouldn't appreciate that remark, I think. Although the ancient Chinese attributed the mountain with the quality of benevolence, this does not mean that they did not regard the mountain without fear and foreboding. Indeed, mountains were not only considered divine, they were often considered gods. For example, the earliest written Chinese texts, the oracle inscriptions of the Song Dynasty, have numerous records of sacrifices made to mountains as deities. Mountains were also the home of various demons, ghosts, and sprites. They were thought to do harm to anyone who entered their realm. As late as the 4th century, the Taoist Ge Hong begins his essay titled Ascending Mountains and Crossing Streams with a following warning to anyone who would carelessly venture into the mountains. So keep this in mind if you're going to go into the mountains this weekend. "Of all those who compound drugs for the sake of pursuing the way, as well as those who dwell in hiding to escape from disturbance, there are none who do not enter the mountain. Yet those who are not aware of the procedures for entering the mountains may many times could come to hazard and harm. Hence there is the proverb, at the foot of Mount Taihua, bleached bones are strewn in a clutter. Mountains, whether large or small, are in all cases possessed of divine noumena. If the mountain be large, then the divinity is a great one. If the mountain be small, then the divinity is a lesser one. Entering a mountain without being in possession of the proper magical arts, one is certain to find calamity and harm." This translation, with one minor change, is by my good friend Paul Kroll of the University of Colorado. Gu Hong then goes on to enumerate the various perils and hazards that could befall someone who ventures into the mountains. And he also provides a long list of magical formula that one can use to avoid calamity during a trek in the mountains. I should mention that in ancient China, the mountain was considered the realm of the immortals, or more precisely, the undying. That is, persons who, by means of various breath control exercises and the ingestion of elixirs and herbs, were able to attain long lifespans and even immortality. Mountains were also the source of these life-prolonging substances, and one of the main reasons many people in ancient China climbed mountains was to obtain rare herbs and minerals. In early Chinese writing, one could journey to a mountain not only by physically climbing it, but also in one's imagination. Such travels were called in Chinese yuan you, or far roaming, and involved a journey of the spirit to a far place. Perhaps the most impressive early Chinese literary work that recounts a spiritual journey to a mountain peak is the exposition on roaming the Tiantai Mountain by the 4th century writer Sun Chuo. In this piece, Sun portrays an imaginary journey to the Tiantai Mountains of eastern Zhejiang. By the 4th century, this area had become an important scenic site as well as a Buddhist and Taoist center. Sun begins by describing the physical features of the peaks, which he never visited. This is all imaginary. He focuses on the two most important sites. One is called the Chuchang, the Scarlet Wall. You can see that kind of reddish cliff there. That's what that is. This is a cragged cliff towering over 300 meters. And then something else that I don't have a good photograph of is called the Pubu, the Cascade, the Waterfall. This is a huge waterfall located in the southwestern part of the range. And as he progresses up the slope, Sun imagines himself roaming the peak with Taoist immortals. And I just give you two lines here. I meet plumed men on Cinnabar Hill. I search for the blessed chambers of the undying. And Sun portrays his ascent of Mount Tiantai with the quest for attaining the state of immortality. Although the trek up the peak is difficult and dangerous, at the summit his path is smooth, level, and straight. And this is, of course, a metaphor for the success of his spiritual journey. Sun Chuo ends the poem in the realm of pure philosophy, in which actually he blends paired after another a series of Buddhist and Taoist ideas. Well, all of what I have discussed to this point is introductory to the main focus of my lecture, the mountain viewing of Xie Lingyun, who is arguably the most avid mountain lover of early medieval China. Xie came from one of the most distinguished aristocratic families of his day. The Xie family originally was from North China, but moved to South China in the early 4th century. They established an estate in the mountains of southeast China in an area called Shuning. Today, this is near the city of Shaoxing in the province of Zhejiang. The original estate, known as Eastern Mountain, had been established by Xie Lingyun's grandfather, a man named Xie Xuan. And here is a map that was not created by me, but one of my talented graduate students, who's now teaching in Boston, but not at the Cambridge Community College, a much more important place. This is done by Christopher Dakin. Not an easy map to put together. You want to know basically the size we're talking about. This estate occupies nearly two modern counties in Zhejiang province. He had a little bit of land, I guess. Well, Xie arrived at his estate in the autumn of 423 and remained there for 3 years when the emperor summoned him to the capital to take up the position of director of the imperial library. And he returned then to Shuning briefly from April 428, where he enjoyed a life of leisure and continued to write poetry. He and his friends frequently went out to a place called Thousand Autumns Precinct House, where they bared themselves, drank wine, and shouted at the top of their lungs. And this is somebody trying to portray this, although I think that the Chinese term the luo shan probably means that he was bare, you know, his entire body was naked. I don't think it's just this part here. Well, when the local governor complained of the commotion that Xie and his party were making, he replied, "If I want to shout at the top of my lungs, what concern is it of that idiot governor?" Xie's overbearing manner and arrogance eventually led to his demise. Soon after offending the local governor, Xie was charged with plotting rebellion. Although he successfully defended himself, he was sent into exile, eventually ending up in what is now modern Canton, where he was executed in the marketplace. So even your wealth couldn't guarantee a long life for you in this period. Well, Paul de Mieville calls Xie Lingyun, quote, the creator of Chinese landscape poetry, or more precisely, mountain poetry, unquote. When Xie lived in this area of Shining, he devoted himself to expanding his estate, writing poetry, and studying Buddhism. And this was a highly productive period for his poetry. Xie describes his life at Shining in a long poem called, in Chinese, the Shanju Fu, or Exposition on Dwelling in the Mountains. And this is from a Ming Dynasty edition of this piece. Now, the Chinese word I have translated as exposition is Fu. As my students and some of my colleagues know, this is a word I usually do not translate. The Fu has no exact equivalent in Western literature. The term has been variously translated as rhapsody, a translation I used for many years, rhyme prose, a poetic essay, and exposition. Exposition is a translation that my former student and also now a professor at the Cambridge Community College, Stephen Owen, uses. The Fu emerged into maturity during the early Han Dynasty, that is the 2nd century BCE, when poets at the imperial court began to compose long, difficult poems against which the genre is traditionally measured. This type of Fu has the following features: an ornate style, lines of unequal length, a mixture of rhymed and unrhymed passages, extensive parallelism, hyperbole, repetition of synonyms that either rhyme or alliterate, a difficult language, and often a moral conclusion. Xie also self-consciously sets his exposition apart from the earlier Fu tradition, especially the court Fu of the Han period. He declares that his exposition is an attempt to present an alternative to the grand descriptions of cities and palaces and parks that were celebrated by the court poets of the Han. As he puts it, quote, "Now what I write about is not the splendor of capitals, palaces, lodges, excursion hunts, grand sights and sounds, but rather tell of the mountain and countryside, plants and trees, waters and rocks, grains and farming." And this is indeed a topic that was new to this genre, and his account of his mountain estate reflects new ideas about mountain viewing and visualization that had emerged in the early 4th century CE. These new views of visualization are informed mainly by Buddhism, but also by Taoism. It was just in this period that many members of the Chinese elite began to take a strong interest in Buddhism. My good friend, Professor Tian Xiaofei, also of the Cambridge Community College, recently has published a long article on what she calls the new discourse of seeing in the 4th century. Using Buddhist and Taoist sources, Professor Tian shows that viewing was conceived of as a process of, quote, stopping and stilling of actions and passions in order to achieve a serene concentration, unquote, and applying the power of concentration to obtain an enlightened observation of the impermanent nature of reality and seeing things as they really are. Tian further shows that in the 4th century, those who subscribed to this notion of visualization argued that, quote, the mind was so powerful that it could override the physical environment, unquote. What this means is that place did not matter. One could become enlightened or achieve Taoist transcendence anywhere, even in the court or marketplace. Although the conventional wisdom of the time was that a person had to go into hiding into the mountains to achieve peace of mind, the advocates of the new notion of viewing claimed that one could obtain spiritual transcendence anywhere, even in the middle of a crowded place. For example, the late 3rd century poet Lu Ji, in his exposition on replying to praiseworthy withdrawal, says the following: "As long as one can forget his physical body, when he casts aside his official hatpins to become a recluse, why need he go into hiding in a valley? One may compare a large mountain to an inch-high mound and lodge a dense grove in a single tree." The most eloquent expression of the idea that one can attain spiritual transcendence even in the midst of noise and commotion of human settlements is the following passage from a poem by one of Xie Lingyun's contemporaries, Tao Yanming. "Tao served briefly in office, but in the year 405, retired for good to a farm located close to one of China's most beautiful mountains, Mount Lu, in modern Jiangxi province." Magnificent. Now, I have these lines from Tao's poem. This is from a very famous piece, rather interesting title, 20 Poems Written After Drinking Wine. He was a famous, famous drinker. This is number 5. And it's pretty straightforward, I think. I build my hut in a place where other people live, yet do not hear the noise of carts and horses. You ask, how can I do this? When the mind is detached, the place becomes remote of itself. I pick chrysanthemums by the eastern hedge, carefree and content. I see the southern hills. Now, in the concluding lines of this excerpt from his poem, Tao Yanming juxtaposes the picking of chrysanthemums with looking out on the distant southern hills. And what did he do with these chrysanthemum petals? Well, he infused them in wine and drank it as a potion that reputedly would prolong one's life. So the next time you have some chrysanthemums and even ale will do, I think, try it. And the southern hills here are, of course, Mount Lu. Now, Mount Lu was a major Buddhist center during the time of Xie Lingyun. The most famous Buddhist teacher of Mount Lu was somebody named Hui Yuan, who established a Buddhist retreat at Mount Lu around the year 380. On the eastern side of Mount Lu, Hui Yuan had constructed a large monastery called Donglin, or Eastern Grove. And Xie Lingyun was acquainted with Hui Yuan. Xie Lingyun actually wrote a dirge upon Hui Yuan's death. And in the dirge, he mentions that he had admired Hui Yuan from the early age of 15. And of course, he hadn't met him yet. He only met him some 10 years later when Xie was serving as an aide, actually, to the future founding emperor of the Liuzong dynasty. And the biography of Hui Yuan contained in the Gaoseng Zhuan, the biographies of eminent Buddhist monks, compiled in the 6th century, says the following about their first encounter, and this tells you a little bit about what kind of person Xie Lingyun was. It says, Xie Lingyun of Chen Commandery, confident in his talents, was arrogant towards ordinary people, and there were few people that he held in high regard. He was a real arrogant, you know what. As soon as he met Hui Yuan, he reverently submitted to him in his heart. Well, we do not know how long Xie Lingyun stayed on Mount Lu, but we know that he was involved in an important event that occurred on Mount Lu in the spring of 412. Hui Yuan had become interested in the story of Buddha's shadow, which was reported throughout Buddhist circles in China by the monk Fa Xian, who had seen it in the year 399 in a cave of Nagarhara, that's in modern Afghanistan. The shadow reputedly had been left there by Buddha himself. After hearing the account given by Fa Xian, Hui Yuan decided to have a copy of the Buddha shadow painted on silk and put in a shrine that backed to a mountain and overlooked a river. The image was hung in the shrine on 27th May 412. And Xie Lingyun himself was commissioned to write an inscription on it. Now, Xie Lingyun is a rather interesting person. He actually even had some knowledge of Sanskrit, and I can cite no better authority on this matter than Professor Rao Zongyi. Notice the date of his birth. He's still alive. Professor Rao, who lives in Hong Kong, is the most learned living Chinese scholar I know. He is now 92 years old. Professor Rao's collected works, this is just his scholarly works, published in 2003 amounted to 20 large volumes. And he has been publishing steadily ever since. And keep in mind also, he is a painter and a calligrapher, and those collections are just huge. Professor Rao has done some of the most insightful studies of the history of Sanskrit in China. And he has shown that Xie Lingyun is the first Chinese poet who knew Sanskrit. Professor Rao also notes that Xie was also the first Chinese to write an account of the Kharosthi script. And we have the leading authority in the Western world, Professor Richard Solomon, on the Kharosthi script in the audience tonight. I think I saw him come in, and a previous COTS lecturer. Xie Lingyun was also an expert in the Buddhological realm. Xie, together with two Buddhist monks, polished up a Chinese translation of the Mahaparinirvana Sutra. He also wrote a commentary to the Diamond Sutra and composed a set of 8 encomia for analogies that the Vimalakirti Sutra uses to illustrate the impermanence of the human body. Very nice things. Bubble, you can see, bubbles don't last very long. Foam, flame, etc. Well, let us now turn to Xieling Yun's exposition on his mountain dwelling. Xie, as I mentioned, composed the poem in the period 423 to 26 while he was residing in Shining. He also did something rather remarkable. He wrote his own commentary to the piece. Thank goodness, because we would not be able to understand very much of it today without his commentary. So Xieling Yun begins the Fu with a prose introduction in which he sets forth the principles on which he based both the writing of his Fu and the design of his estate. After this long prolegomena, Xieling Yun launches into a description of the estate. The opening section begins with the following line. To the left, there is a lake. On the right is a river. And we go back to our map here. The lake and river that Xie mentions are undoubtedly the two lakes. You see those? Do those show up there? Can you see that? Okay. All right. And then this river is the Puyang River. You see, it goes like that. It's the modern Cao'e River today, a very famous river in Zhejiang Province. And the Wu Lakes, there were two of them. They had another name. We don't need to go into that. But apparently this was a rather large lake that covered a large part of that territory. We don't know exactly how much, but they disappeared around maybe 11th or 12th century. They just dried up. And this river still is there. Now, although waters occupy a significant place in Xie's account of the estate, it is the mountains that truly dominate the landscape. So in the following lines of the section mentioned above, he refers to the mountains. He says, it faces mountains and backs onto small hills. On the east it is obstructed, on the west it slopes downward. And then the commentary, he tells us that these mountains were within the surrounding waters. Now, Xie's estate included two prominent peaks, both located in the southern section. The first here is this, if I can get this down here, right here, do you see that? It's about two, and I'll show you a photograph of it. And then the other one is right across there, this Sheng Mountain, okay. Take a look at this. Is that an impressive mountain? No. by our standards, this is not much of anything. The only thing I can say in Xie's defense is there were much more trees. This area became deforested, and as I will show, maybe he contributed to the deforestation. Well, Xieling Yun's estate actually consisted of two sections, which he refers to in his Fu as North Mountain and South Mountain. North Mountain is the original estate of his grandfather. And we'll see what the south section is in a moment. Well, in describing the estate, Xie follows the model of the Han Fu writers and proceeds in the ritually correct order of the four directions, east, south, west, and north. And so thus he begins with four sections that begin respectively nearby to the east, nearby to the south, nearby to the west, and nearby to the north. Francis Westbrook, who was my student at Yale in the late 1960s, wrote his 1972 Yale dissertation on Xieling Yun. And there is from the title page of this dissertation. You can see, unfortunately, that Frank Westbrook, as I'm going to call him from now on, did not have a long life or even a long academic career. Anyway, Westbrook has astutely commented on this organizational feature of Xie's Fu, and this is a very brief quotation. He says, Xie uses the directional formula as part of the word magic of his description, and rhetorically to place his dwelling at the center of the cosmos, the same way the Han Fu writers did the emperor's court. Xie creates of his estate a microcosm of the universe, which is this, I think, is very well put. However, Xieling Yun does the Han Fu writers one better by repeating the directional formula twice, first to describe the nearby vistas and then those in the distance. Thus, he follows with an account of the places in the distant east, the distant south, distant west, and distant north. And what is striking about Xie's presentation of this information is how he goes from the tiniest local sites to the remote but famous southeastern landmarks. For example, the nearby eastern section is little more than an enumeration of the names of a field, a lake, gorge, valley, and hill. you can see this here. Near to the east are Upper Fields, Lower Lake, Western Gorge, Southern Valley, Stony Knoll, Stony Confluence, Min Millstone, and Yellow Bamboo. Although this is a local miniature landscape, in the following lines, Scheer portrays it on an almost universal scale. Bursting forth are waterfalls cascading for hundreds of yards. Standing in rows are tall copses ranged over 1,000 foothills. The waters pour forth their long flow into a distant river. A tributary from a deep spring feeds a nearby irrigation ditch. So the waterfalls, which are literally in Chinese flying founts, cascade down from a crevice of an extreme height, literally 108 feet spans. And thick bushes grow over a countless number of foothills. And in the final couplet, you can see Xie creates a totality by juxtaposing the distant river into which the waters flow with a nearby irrigation ditch. In this section, Xie does not forget to describe the mountains as well as the waters. He writes the following couplet that describes the large boulders that hang perilously from the cliffs. Crags collapse and fly from the eastern scarps. Boulders rise mighty and grand on western paths. In the commentary, Xie mentions the terror that these boulders arouse, but also their practical function as markers of the former county seat. He says, "At the southern boundary of my mountain dwelling, there are stones leaping forth as if about to collapse into the river. No one walking here would fail to take fright. The boulders mark the site of the former administrative center of this county." So even though Xie Lingyun identifies the dangers of the beetling cliffs, his fears do not rise to the level of the mountain gloom of the medieval European mountain travelers. In the section on the sites on the nearby west, Xie lists various otherwise unknown mountains. I wish we knew what these were. And some of them have rather evocative names, like Grand and August, or the tiered mountain, or the one I like is Gu, which just means orphan or solitary. And he concludes the section with two intriguing lines. It says, "The moon hides in the mountains and all turns dark. On the trees, branches begin to sing and the wind rises." Frank Westbrook cites this couplet as an example of a technique found occasionally in Xie Lingyun's writing. What Westbrook says, "Perceiving something indirectly or with a sense other than the one normally required for its perception." And one famous example is the following couplet in the poem, Xie wrote near the end of his life. This is the one here. "Entering the mouth of Lake Pengli," says, "By the light of the moon, I listen to the mournful gibbons, soaked with dew. More fragrant becomes the sweet calamus." Here we see Xie blending the senses. So he's using the visual sense of sight, the moonlight, to hear the shrieks of the gibbons deep in the hills. And he uses the tactile sense of touch to smell the fragrance of the calamus in the night air. Now, if we go back to this line that is very interesting from that couplet, this line, which I translate, "On the trees, branches begin to sing and the wind rises." If you read this grammatically, it should say, "The trees make their branches sing and thereby give rise to wind." Counterintuitive. Very counterintuitive formulation, for normally it's the wind that blows through the trees causing the branches to sound, right? However, we learn from Xie's commentary that what actually sings are the birds perched on the branches. It says, "Birds gather on the branches and sing. Thus, I say, there is wind." But as Westbrook notes, this explanation adds further ambiguity. He says, "More than a confusion of senses, we now have a confusion about what is perceived by one sense," unquote. Indeed, one wonders whether the wind is even involved here, for the word feng can mean both wind and musical air. And we wonder, could Xie be punning on its double meaning? The musical air, of course, could be the songs made by the chirping birds. Well, toward the middle of his exposition, Xie begins to describe the estate itself. From the outset, Xie makes it clear that his construction of buildings is intended to enhance viewing. after telling how he refurbishes the old dwellings to create two new lodges, he mentions the placing of doors and windows to facilitate viewing not only the scenery but also the fields that were undoubtedly a prime source of income. I gapped a southern door in order to face the distant peaks, opened an eastern window in order to view the nearby fields. Although this kind of viewing is a recumbent, sedentary one, we shall see that Xie was not content with looking at his estate only from a window. In designating some of the important places on his estate, Xie seems to have distinguished between the gardens, which he calls Yuan, which were primarily used for viewing scenery, and the fields, the Qian, in which he planted all kinds of crops. And Xie's activities in the fields are very kinetic but also frenetic. He devotes many lines to recounting how he and his retainers fell trees, cut down brush, cull shoots and strip skin from bamboo, pick fruit, pull grass, forage for wild grapes, brew ale, cut mulberry fruits, peel bark to make paper, dig up plants to make dye, knot ropes, make mats, throw pots, thresh grain and gather honey. And there are many, many long lines that deal with this. Xie Lingyun does not spend all of his time farming. He devotes many passages to recount his treks to various sites on his estate. For example, he tells of his visit to what he calls the watery precincts, the Shui Qu. Xie does a bit of work here, such as dredging stream beds and removing tangled plants that choke the wild rice fields. But it is the scenery that occupies his attention. This is what it says. Warm springs gush forth in early spring torrents. Cold waves dash as autumn rushes onward. Wind stirs waves on isles where thoroughwort grows. The sun refracts its light on the Fagara-planted path. A water-soaked terrace soars from an island in the river. There we take pleasure in the moon reflected in the water. At dawn, shadows stretch and everything is cool. At dusk, fragrance gathers and the sweet aroma spreads. Now, take a look. Well, I'll show you here. We can just want to have this one singled out. This is the fourth line in that previous slide. You can see the sun refracts its light on the Fagara-planted path. Okay. Well, the phrase here, Dao Jing, upside down sunlight, refracted sunlight, it can also be read in the sense of Dao Ying, casting inverted shadows. And again, this is an example of Xie Lingyun's use of ambiguous language. Although I had to commit myself to one translation, I am not sure whether it is the sunlight or the shadow of the mountain that is cast onto the road. And Xie continues in the next line, literally to seize the pleasure and joy of the moonlight reflected in the water. And he follows this with another light image. The sun literally stretches out shadows. Well, like the exposition writers of the Han, Xie Lingyun includes long catalogs, first of the plants that grow on his estate. It's quite a chore to identify them all. But I think I've found just about every one. And then a list of animals that he introduces with a short introduction. He says, not only do plants grow here, animals also here abound. They fly and swim, run and leap. How can one trace their root and origin? I view their appearance and examine their sound, and I find them fully arrayed over mountains and streams. Now, this is a very intriguing statement about viewing. The term I have translated as animals is literally the moving species, the donglei. Unlike the plants, which are literally zhiwu, planted or stationary, these creatures move. They fly, they swim, they run, they jump. Because they are constantly moving, it is hard, quote, to trace their root and origin, unquote, as Xie says. But Xie does manage to view them. He says he views their appearance and examines their sound and sees them in full display on the landscape. It seems that Xie considers that living creatures are part of the landscape. Thus, in the prose commentary, this is what he says, there were several kinds of animals. There are those that roar, those that soar, and those that run gallop, and those that soar leap. I say that their species are so numerous, I cannot keep track of them. If I only observe their appearance and examine their sounds, I can know the beauty of mountain and stream. Schellingen devotes much of the last portion of the Fu to describing the South Mountain section of the estate, and this is the part that he developed himself. Before giving a description, Scher first tells how he goes out alone to survey the grounds to formulate a design. When I first laid out a plan and design for my estate, leaning on a walking stick, I traveled alone. I entered streams, forded rivers, climbed peaks, and walked over mountains. Upon traversing a summit, I did not rest. Upon tracing a spring to its source, I did not stop. Knowing that Schellingen had a huge staff of retainers and companions that constantly accompanied him, one might be skeptical about his statement that he traveled alone. This phrase, as applied to human travel, does not seem to be much earlier than Xie. Tao Yanming uses it once. What is more striking about this passage is how Xie describes his perambulations. His activity is almost frenetic. In the space of four lines, he crosses streams and rivers, scales mountain peaks, and does not even rest once. Once he gets to the summit or reaches the end of a waterway. Xie portrays himself here as a blazer of trails who ventures into unexplored territory. Cutting through thick growth, I opened a trail, I explored rocks, scoured cliffs. On all sides, mountains wound around me. A pair of streams sinuously flowed. Well, Xie may not have intended this account of his climbing and fording as a literal account of his physical feats, for he may have mentioned it to represent the arduous efforts he made toward a more spiritual purpose. Xie tells us in the following lines that the result of his exploration was the construction of buildings for Buddhist monks who lived on his estate, at least for part of the year. And I don't have this on the screen, but I'll read it to you. Facing the southern peaks, I built a scripture terrace. Against the northern hill, I constructed a lecture hall. Beside a precipitous peak, I set a meditation chamber. Overlooking a deep stream, I placed houses for monks. In the concluding lines to this section, Xie explains why this mountain setting is most suitable for these Buddhist guests, and presumably also for Xie. I bid farewell to the pretty pagodas of the suburbs. I withdraw from the world by the city walls. I am delighted to see simplicity and embrace the uncarved block, and I truly have found sweet dew in the place of the way. The uncarved block is a concept that goes back to the Taoist classic Lao Tzu. This is a piece of wood that has not been worked in any way, and it represents the uncontaminated, pristine nature of things. The place of the way, Dao Chang, or platform of the path, is a Chinese translation of Bodhimandala, literally truth plot. And here it designates the place for attaining the Buddhist truth. A Bodhimandala also is a place where a bodhisattva makes an appearance and can be seen by devout believers. And in China, certain mountains were designated as Bodhimandala. It is doubtful, however, that any of the mountains on Xie's estate ever got this status. In his commentary, Xie adds a few words of explanation to the line cited above. And this is kind of interesting. He says, "He who is poor does not consider the merely pretty as beautiful. That is why I have found contentment in a thatched hut." And of course, he's one of the wealthiest persons in China at this time. "Thus I bid farewell to the suburbs and withdrew from city walls. Truly pure emptiness and quiet solitude are the place where one can obtain the way." And Frank Westbrook notes that here we should not take Xie's statement about poverty literally, for he is likely quoting striking a Buddhist pose, emphasizing his devotion to simplicity and the uncarved block. So the Taoism comes in here too. After a section in which he relates the religious activities and spiritual purity of the Buddhist monks, Xie follows with a similar section to tell of the Taoist practitioners who were also welcome on his estate. Although Xie portrays both groups favorably, in his commentary he rates the Taoists a bit lower, for, as he said, they had not reached the heights of the Buddhist way. So any Taoists in here, I hope you won't take offense. On the western side of the grounds, Xie erected a lodge, the construction of which he portrays as virtually growing out of the natural surroundings. "Against the northern crest, I have built a lodge. Looking down from the southern peak, I placed the veranda. Layered cliffs are displayed in the doorway. Mirror-like ripples are arrayed before the window. I use cinnabar-colored mist to serve as scarlet lintels. Attach praise-colored clouds to make green rafters. You want to go up in the Cascades and try to make something with all of these things? Well, this is, again, an attempt by Xie to de-emphasize artifice and represent the human-made structures on his estate as natural and simple. He does this all the way through. In addition to moving about and the kinetic viewing, as I call it, has nothing to do with my last name. Xie tells us he was involved in sedentary activities, especially with monks who come here from both far and near during the rain season for the what's called in Chinese the anju, the tranquil dwelling, or the varsha, to meditate and study. He says the monks tranquilly dwell for two seasons, in winter and summer, each 3 months. There are monks who come from afar. The nearby sangha also are not absent. In contrast to the frenetic activity of his trekking and climbing and the arduous toil of his retainer farmers, all of the participants in the meditation sessions are still and motionless. The landscape, too, is tranquil. In the mountains, it is quiet and still. Here, from all entanglements, one is cut off. And then I have a break. Even when the silence is broken by the moans of a cold wind or the hot sun bears down on them, the landscape provides relief. And these are marvelous lines. The cold wind soughs and sighs, but facing the southern slopes, one is always warm. The sun's fiery light blazes strong, but toward the northern faces, there is frost and snow. Well, Xie's viewing at this point is no longer done by physically climbing and roaming, but by resting in a tall terrace and sitting on the bank of a stream. Although Xie continues his Fu for 3 more sections, he ends his description of the estate here. However, the last section of the Fu gives some indication of what kind of vision Xie Lingyun sought. He says, since eyes and ears provide no direction, how can one tread in footprints? All time is collected in the 3 seasons. I await the comprehensive vision of the 5 eyes. And anyone who knows anything about Buddhism probably knows what's going on here, and I'll explain. Here we can see that Xie is intent on seeking a spiritual vision that transcends time distinctions. Thus all time is concentrated in 3 seasons. In his commentary, Xie says, and we have it there, I say that since this is not something that one can seek through human footprints, I shall await the triple sight in the 5 eyes. Only then I can tread forth. Thus I halt my brush, stop writing, and say no more. I hope that some understanding and sympathetic person will comprehend my meaning. And here, maybe he succeeded. You have this non-Chinese foreigner reading his work here in this long period, long after he wrote it. Well, Xie seems to be saying here that one cannot trust one's normal vision or auditory senses, and thus physically roaming and viewing are not effective means for obtaining true spiritual illumination, which he designates by the Buddhist concepts of Sanming, triple sight, and Wuyan, 5 eyes. Well, I'm not going to bore you with a long explication of these complicated Buddhist terms. I will only mention that both triple sight and the 5 eyes include what is called the divine eye or deva eye, tianyan, that enables one to obtain an instantaneous, unlimited vision of any object in the universe. Although there are higher forms of vision in this Buddhist scheme of visualization, divine eye is often mentioned in Buddhist writings of Xie Lingyun's time as the ideal method of vision for most Buddhist devotees. Xie Lingyun does not tell us how he hopes to obtain the triple sight and the ability to see with the 5 eyes, but he does imply that he cannot attain the spiritual vision by kinetic activity. Indeed, he seems to imply that sitting still and contemplating the mountain is more effective than physically roaming the peaks of his estate. Thus, for all of what Xie says about the delights of mountain exploration, like Petrarch, it would seem that his interest in mountains, in mountain viewing, were also of a spiritual order. Although Xie Lingyun did not, like Petrarch, obtain his inspiration from a single miniature book that he carried with him up the mountain, like Petrarch, Xie also turns his inner eye to himself quietly to contemplate and even savor the spiritual comfort that his mountain retreat gives him. I suspect the idea that simply by sitting and engaging in intense concentration or samadhi, one could obtain true wisdom and insight into the ultimate reality was something that Schellinger had obtained from Huiyuan. Huiyuan had introduced the Buddhist idea of nianfo, or Buddhist recollection, which he deemed the most effective means of concentration. Huiyuan's main source for this idea was a work called in Chinese, the Banzhou Sanmei Jing, the Pratyutpanna Samadhi Sutra. Mike can correct my pronunciation. I got this pronunciation from him, but I probably didn't hear it very well. Anyway, this had been translated into Chinese as early as the... There we go. This had been translated into Chinese as early as the 2nd century of the Common Era. And my learned colleague, Richard Solomon, tells me that Pratyutpanna etymologically means rising up in front of one, but also has the sense of present in time or in space. And according to this sutra, Buddha recollection enabled a person to visualize all Buddhas of the present as if they were standing before one's eyes, and that's taken right out of the text. And the vision did not need to be realized by means of the divine eye or divine ear. The sutra specifically says Buddha recollection is a method that can be performed by a monk, a nun, or even a male or female layperson. All one has to do is go to a secluded place and concentrate the mind for 7 days, after which time the Buddha will reveal himself before the person's eyes. Perhaps it was because Xie had been exposed to Huiyuan's teaching of Buddha recollection that he ends his account of mountain viewing by reverting to sedentary contemplation. I mentioned earlier in my talk that Schellinger was acquainted with the Buddha shadow that Huiyuan had painted in a shrine in Mount Lu. The shadow, along with dreams and reflected light, are common images in medieval Chinese Buddhism to represent the illusory nature of things. You may recall the line I cited previously in which it is not certain whether it is the light of the sun or the shadow of the mountain that is cast on the road. We have seen other lines in which Xie's encounter with the landscape involves a blurring of the senses that verges on the illusory. I think it is clear that to Xie the mountain is there, but it's also not there. What I mean by this is that in Xie's Buddhist universe, the ultimate reality lies beyond the physical appearance of the mountain. Thus, the ultimate appeal of the mountainscape lies in the mystic vision that he attains through Buddha contemplation. However, Xie does not go as far as Tao Yanming or the 4th century Chinese writers who argued that one could obtain spiritual inspiration anywhere. I'm sure that Xie was convinced that only in his mountain abode could he attain the spiritual vision he sought. Okay, this is all theory. Now we're going to get some realia. I should mention in closing that Schellinger not only found the mountain a potential source of spiritual inspiration, for Xie's mountain estate was also an important economic unit. For example, while Xie was describing his estate as a plain mountain retreat, he was engaged in a large expansion of the estate that involved the draining of lakes and swamps, reclamation of wasteland, and planting large plots of land with grains, vegetables, and fruit trees. And we know that Schellinger could be a demanding taskmaster. In order to accomplish all of this toil, he had a large corps of slaves and retainers who did the work of what one source characterizes as boring through mountains and draining lakes, unquote. We also know that another member of the Xie family had an estate in this area in which he owned over 1,000 slaves. According to Shen Yue, the author of the earliest extant biography of Schellinger, Xie was indeed a demanding taskmaster. Quote, his retainers dug ponds, erected hedges, planted bamboo and shrubby althea. He drove and dispatched laborers with no time limit for their release. And then elsewhere, Shen says, the retainers toiled without surcease, unquote. Xie's activities took him long distances from his estate. On one occasion, he and his army of several hundred retainers hacked a trail through the mountains from South Mountain to Linhai, located some 100 kilometers to the southeast. When they reached Linhai, the local governor took alarm, for he thought that Xie and his party were mountain bandits. Although the governor was relieved when he discovered Xie's identity, he would not permit Xie to continue his trailblazing. In attempting to expand his estate, Schellinger turns out to be no different from the Han Dynasty emperors, who were continuously appropriating valuable land to increase the size of their imperial parks. Although Xieling-Yun may have been inspired by Buddhist and Taoist ideals, like the Han emperors, he used his parks and gardens to maintain and enhance his wealth. And despite his renunciation of the pursuit of sensual pleasures, Xie seems to have spent a good deal of time on his estate engaged in drinking bouts with relatives and cronies, several of whom were famous libertines. According to Shen Yue in 428, when Xie had returned to Shining on sick leave, quote, he played and reveled, held feasts and gatherings that went on day and night, unquote. And as a result of this behavior, he was impeached and dismissed from office. The Tang Dynasty poet Bo Juyi wrote a poem about Xieling-Yun titled Reading the Poems of Xieling-Yun. And one of the couplets reads, for the large, he invariably encompasses the sky and the sea. For the small, he does not leave out a single plant or tree. These lines, which point to the expansiveness of Xieling-Yun's aesthetic vision, could apply as well to his exposition on dwelling in the mountains. In terms of comprehensiveness and fullness and the tendency toward an encyclopedic portrayal of the subject, Xie's account of his estate is not significantly different from the Han expositions on imperial parks. Xie could not resist the urge to celebrate the vastness of his mountain garden, as he calls it, as much more than that. In particular, if we remind ourselves of the concrete reality of his estate, which occupied, as I mentioned, almost two modern counties in Zhejiang province and was a thriving manorial economic unit, we perhaps can understand that behind the poetic account of the estate that he gives us, there lies a reality that may not be consistent with what the poet espouses in the exposition itself. Of course, it is easy from the perspective of 1600 years later to fault this 4th century Chinese aristocrat for his failure to be more self-critical and introspective. The only encounter I have had with Xieling-Yun is through his writings. If I had lived in his time, given my humble background, some of you know I was born in a rural area of Montana, the only chance I would have had to meet him would be as a retainer on his estate. I have no doubt that he was not a benevolent master. Nevertheless, I am grateful to him for providing us with such a detailed account of his mountain home. No other writer of his time deigned to do so. Thank you in Chinese is Xie Xie. This Xie is the same character as Xie of Xieling-Yun. So I will end my talk with this tribute to him. Xie Xie, Xie, thank you, Xie.